Thank you. Good morning. Come into this place of peace and let its silence heal your spirit. Come into this place of memory and let its history warm your soul. Come into this place of prophecy and power and let its vision change your heart. Good morning. I'm Elke Lorenz. I'm your convener this morning, and I would like to welcome all of you to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. We are glad you are here. We would like to extend a special welcome to our guests and first-time visitors. I'm sure you received a warm welcome in the narthex. If you would like to receive our newsletter, please sign your name if you haven't done so already. And if you would like to introduce yourself or be introduced, please do so at this time. Welcome again. At this point, we would like to light the chalice. We light this chalice to affirm that new light is ever waiting to break through to enlighten our ways, that new truth is ever waiting to break through to illuminate our minds, and that new love is ever waiting to break through to warm our hearts. May we be open to this light and to the rich possibilities that it brings us. I would like to refer you to the announcements in our order of service. There is one additional announcement that I would like to make, and that is if you are interested in going to the cluster retreat down in Council Grove, which is an annual event for UUs in the region, you only have 3 more days to register, and information is in the narthex. So if you would like to go to the cluster retreat, please sign up as soon as possible. We are now going to sing our opening hymn, 346. Come sing a song with me. Now is the time in our order of service when we share those significant joys and concerns we carry in our hearts and minds. By sharing heavy burdens, they are lightened. By sharing joys, they grow. Please say your name when you share a joy or concern and hold the mic in a way so we can understand you. Thank you. That is close to the mouth. Are there any joys or concerns?
This is Kim Bellinger. My joy is all the beautiful new artwork we have hanging in the narthex. Thank you for all the artists, young and old, who submitted something. And everybody take a time to look closely. It's really beautiful. Thank you.
Amy Fowler. I got my acceptance letter this week to a K-State, the Family Studies program, so I'm pretty excited.
Good morning, Shirley Hobrock. If anyone this morning has not signed up to get their picture in the directory. This would be new people, not people that had it taken a year and a half ago. You're welcome to come afterwards and try and get in the schedule.
Destiny has something to say.
I had a sleepover last night. Me and Riley had sleepover too.
Thank you for sharing concerns, spoken and unspoken, and the joys, of course. We had more joys. That's good. Is it now time for our children's story, Corey?
Hello. All the children are... Come on up. Join us. Join us. Okay. So, I have these super special pencils with me today. They're beautiful. And, I really feel like giving them out. I do. They're so beautiful. But I really only want to give them to super special people. So if you have blue eyes, I think you are super special. So if you have blue eyes, come on and stand up here. Blue-eyed people are so special. They're the most special people. Look. Look how beautiful they are. Oh, fantastic. Look. Burke, great. Oh, don't worry, I have more for blue-eyed people. Yeah. Okay. Blue eyes. There you go. Okay, just you. Okay, thanks. Those, I'm just going to give them to the blue-eyed people today. Yeah, okay. Thanks, guys. Aren't they so special? And now they have pencils. Really special. They're so special. Wait, what's wrong with that? They have these beautiful blue eyes. I really thought I have blue eyes and I'm special, so I'm going to just pick the people who look like me and are also super special. I'll take some comments. There seems to be some disagreement about this. Yes.
Mm-hmm. We both both have brown hair, though.
Yeah, we do. That's right. But I really think it's the blue eyes that make me beautiful. Yeah. You do have brown hair. It's just a shame you don't have blue eyes. Yeah, it really is. It just really is.
I have green eyes.
You have green eyes. That is super unique. Not blue, though, but really amazing. Amazing. What is so special about blue? Everything. I agree. I agree. Wait. I thought I would wear blue today to accentuate my blue eyes. Yeah. And you're also wearing blue. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about this. Brown-eyed people, are they the same as blue-eyed people? Do we see the same? You have the same nose, potentially. We talked about hair color before. Do you think people without blue eyes are still special in their own way? So was it fair for me to and I'm going to use a word here, prejudge, right? Was it fair for me to think that brown-eyed people weren't special just because they're not like me? You're still special. That's right. You are still special. Okay, so if you have a different eye color than blue, so if you have green or brown, why don't you also come up here today? Let's look at you guys. Also special. Also special. You do have brown eyes, and they're beautiful. All right. Okay. So I think the lesson we learned today is that it doesn't really matter what we look like. If we have blue eyes or brown eyes or green eyes, we should treat each other the same. That's right. Thanks, Destiny. Okay. Thank you, guys.
It is now time for the offertory. Let there be an offering to sustain and strengthen this place, which is a community of hope. From arrogance, pompousness, and from thinking ourselves more important than we are, may some saving sense of humor liberate us. For allowing ourselves to ridicule the faith of others, may we be forgiven. From making war and calling it peace, special privilege and calling it justice, indifference and calling it tolerance, pollution and calling it progress, may we be cured. For telling ourselves and others that evil is inevitable while good is impossible, may we stand corrected. Spirit of our mixed up, tragic, aspiring, doubting, and insurgent lives, help us to be as good as in our hearts we have always wanted to be. Blessed be. It is my great pleasure and privilege to introduce today's speaker, Roger Friedman. Roger is the son of our member, Ruth Friedman. I wanted to mention that too. And Roger is teaching English at K-State University, including technical writing and Holocaust literature. And his teaching of Holocaust literature inspired him to go more deeply into defining anti-Semitism. And we are pleased to welcome Roger to speak to us today.
Well, As was mentioned, I'd been teaching Holocaust literature. I think the first time I taught the course was in 2004, and I had written some articles concerning some authors previous to that. And the more I examined the literature, the fiction, the poems, the plays, the more I wondered about the history and how it came to be. And it's been a vexing question and almost an obsession for me in terms of reading articles and articles and articles on the subject. And today I want to share some thinking that I think is current. It's not necessarily my thinking exactly, or at least my thinking based on the thinking of others. And so I'm here to talk about the problem of defining anti-Semitism. We've all heard the expression. But to understand why arriving at a definition of anti-Semitism is a problem, we need to first consider the origin of the term. It's a fairly new word in our lexicon. The word anti-Semitism first appeared in print in 1879, when it was used by the German journalist Wilhelm Marr to replace the Christian theological rationale for prejudice against the Jews in an increasingly secularized Germany, and to replace it with a scientific rationale that he and others believed would be more persuasive. It was based in part on some of the earlier linguistics of that century, Christian Lassen's book, The Indian Antiquities, published in 1847, and Arthur Joseph de Gobineau's book, The Inequality of Races, published in 1854. While neither of these authors had specifically mentioned the Jews in their works, the German linguist Lassen had argued that Semites, the speakers of Semitic languages, which included Hebrew, Arabic, and Aramaic, were egotistical and exclusive, whereas Indo-Europeans, whose languages stemmed from a common origin, were tolerant and altruistic. Gobineau saw in what he called the Aryan race, the blonde, tall, blue-eyed, the ones who get the pencils first, a superior culture-bearing people. Of course, this pseudoscience of race has been discredited, in large part due to the horrific application by Nazi Germany during the 1930s and the war years of 1939 to 1945, when 6 million Jews, two-thirds of European Jewry, were murdered. However, understanding anti-Semitism as the product of a discredited, misguided science has the effect of undergirding what Susanna Heschel calls, quote, the classical distinction between Christian theological anti-Judaism and modern scientific racism. Because science is often presented as the opposite of religion, the ways in which Christian theological teachings informed both German racial thinking at the turn of the 20th century, as well as a growing German nationalism, is obscured, are obscured. This has led to the view of the Holocaust as a sort of historical improvisation, the result of a perfect storm of very unique and unusual circumstances, and to view anti-Semitism as the invention of Hitler. Even Lucy Dadovitz, who wrote in her widely acclaimed Holocaust history, The War Against the Jews, that, quote, a line of anti-Semitic descent from Martin Luther to Adolf Hitler is easy to draw, argues that anti-Jewish sentiment aroused by teaching that Jews were Christ killers is only one cause among three, the other two being racism and German nationalism, and they being distinct from the former. Today, I want to propose to you the idea that both the racial theory of Nazism and its nationalist agenda, the twin pillars of its ideology, were, in fact, possibly the logical and inevitable consequences of the Christian anxieties over the presence of Judaism at the heart of their religion. In this talk, I also want to dispel what I believe are some common misconceptions about the motives for anti-Semitism, such as the belief that Jews are Christ killers. And what I'm saying here, I'm not going to argue that they're not. That's not the subject. But that people think that that belief is at the heart of anti-Semitic thought. Likewise, that Jewish recalcitrance in accepting Christ as the Savior is presenting his second coming, or that Jewish involvement in usury led to the resentment of Jews by Gentiles. However, I am sure some of you are now asking yourselves, how could Nazism be an extension of Christian theology when its ideology had incorporated so many non-Christian beliefs, such as ancestor worship, and even anti-Christian beliefs, such as its professed disdain for Christianity? Nonetheless, the view of Nazi ideology as a pagan and anti-Christian belief system deserves closer scrutiny. Therefore, I want to begin with a historical anecdote. In June 1937, a 13-year-old boy and squad leader in the Hitler Youth Movement wrote to Heinrich Himmler, the Reichsfuhrer SS and head of the German police, asking for some theological advice. Himmler, a leading neo-pagan in the Nazi movement, had formally left the Catholic Church in 1936, but had been lost to Christianity years before. The young squad leader wrote to him about a speech on religion delivered to his troop that was causing him great consternation. He was not sure if he had heard correctly, but he thought he understood the speaker to say that Jesus had been a Jew. He wrote to see if the Reichsfuhrer SS could perhaps enlighten him on this question. He received the following reply from Rudolf Brandt at Himmler's direction, that, quote, the Reichsfuhrer is of the opinion that Christ was not a Jew. You must certainly have misunderstood the speaker. Yet, we need to ask ourselves, how was it that Himmler, the man who would emerge as a committed anti-Christian after the Nazis seized power in 1933, and the Nazi figure who became most famous for his advocacy of the occult and mysticism, needed to assure the boy writing to him that Jesus was not a Jew? Even though Hitler would profess his hatred for Christianity, he never altered his characterization of Jesus as the great anti-Semite, which for him would have been a cause for celebrating Christianity. And that makes it hard to reconcile with his stated disdain for the faith. In fact, Nazi contempt for Christianity often appeared to be more anti-ecclesiastical than an assault on Christian faith in Jesus as a savior figure. Another of the three most important proponents of Nazi paganism was Alfred Rosenberg, who, according to Richard Steigman Gall, was probably the most influential. Steigman Gall notes that while, quote, Rosenberg emphasized Jesus' human temporal acts over his divine transcendence, this did not necessarily mean that Jesus had lost his divinity altogether. In spite of all the Christian churches, Rosenberg would write, Jesus is the linchpin of our history. He became the God of the Europeans. In fact, the only true pagan among the Nazis in the movement's formative years after the First World War was Erich Ludendorff. While he attempted to turn Nazism into an explicitly anti-Christian religious movement, he was eventually expelled from the party in 1928 by Hitler for those views. What's more, most Nazis, including Hitler, continued to revere Martin Luther, the 16th century leader of the Protestant Reformation. Rosenberg credited Luther with the Germanification of Christianity and only found fault with Luther's adherence to his view that the Old Testament remained part of the Christian canon. In fact, Rosenberg held that if the Old Testament were expunged from that canon, Christianity as a religion could be redeemed. Himmler, too, held Luther in high esteem, as well as viewing the Protestant Reformation as a revolt against a church ruled by what Hitler in a March 1940 conversation called the, quote, Jew Popes. And in January 1941, he requested that he be remembered after the war at the Luther Archive at Wittenberg. It's also hard to reconcile, then, the views that Nazism was truly anti-Christian, given the reverence the movement's leaders accorded to one of Christianity's most eminent and influential theologians. For instance, consider this testimony given during the Nuremberg trials by Julius Streicher, the publisher of the Nazi propaganda organ Der Stürmer. And here's what he said. Anti-Semitic publications have existed in Germany for centuries. A book I had written by Dr. Martin Luther was, for instance, confiscated. Dr. Martin Luther would very probably sit in my place in the defendant's dock today if this book had been taken into consideration by the prosecution. In this book, The Jews and Their Lies, Dr. Martin Luther writes that the Jews are a serpent's brood and one should burn down their synagogues and destroy them. The fact is that Luther's own writings from the near the end of his life in 1546 set much of the Nazi policy agenda for the way Jews were to be treated. While Luther had begun his career advocating kindness toward Jews with the aims of converting them to Christianity, he became increasingly bitter toward them when he saw his effort fail. His main works on the Jews, written 3 years before he died, were his 60,000-word treatise on the Jews and their lies, and another essay on the holy name and the lineage of Christ. In these works, he argued that the Jews were no longer the chosen people, but were, quote, the devil's people. They were, quote, base whoring people, that is, no people of God, and their boast of lineage, circumcision, and law must be accounted as filth. The synagogue was the, quote, defiled bride, yes, an incorrigible whore and an evil slut, and the Jews were full of the devil's feces, which they wallow in like swine. He advocated setting synagogues on fire, destroying Jewish prayer books, forbidding rabbis from preaching, seizing Jews' property and money, smashing up their homes, and ensuring that these, quote, poisonous and venomed worms be forced into labor or be expelled for all time. He also seemed to sanction their murder when he wrote, "We are at fault for not slaying them." Rather than being anti-Christian, most of the Nazi elite did not seek to destroy Christianity, but to reform it radically by purging the religion of all of its vestiges of Judaic heritage and recasting it as an Aryan religion, and by disavowing the Christian dogma that Jesus was a Jew. If the Nazis were not as anti-Christian as previously supposed, that then raises questions about the ardor of church resistance to Nazism in Germany. Suffice it to say that within the past three decades, a number of important books have been published probing the acquiescences of churches and prominent Christians, especially Protestant ones, in the Nazi movement. And rather than go through a list of those books, if anyone's interested, I'd be happy to tell you. Where scholarship during the first few decades following the Holocaust was much more likely to examine as causes, one, the perpetrator's fear of the consequences of refusing to obey orders, two, the way in which the tasks involved in exterminating the Jews were incrementalized as to divest the individual perpetrators of their sense of the actual responsibility for murdering human beings, and three, the assumption that the perpetrators were not, in fact, ordinary Germans, but a small, select group of those who had been indoctrinated ideologically. More recent scholarship has had to come to terms with Christendom's view of the followers of the Jesus faith as the long-term animating force behind Nazi policy. To understand how that came to be, we ought then to examine the anxiety afflicting Christian culture that spawned a hatred of the Jews so virulent that their existence was eventually perceived by much of Europe as an existential threat to be acted on accordingly. One long-held explanation for the ferocity of Jew hatred is that the passion narratives in the Gospels cast Jews as the killers of Christ, essentially charging the Jews of Jesus' time with deicide. Yet, that explanation seems to be at odds with any number of biblical verses suggesting that the sins of the father not be visited on the children. For instance, Deuteronomy 24:6 says, "Fathers shall not be put to death because of their children, nor shall children be put to death because of their fathers. Each one shall be put to death for his own sin." What's more, any number of New Testament verses promise forgiveness to those who repent, which leads to a second widely held explanation, that the Jews have been despised for not accepting Jesus as their Savior. However, this explanation is confounded by the historical experience of those Jews who did convert to Christianity. It's worth noting that by the 1930s, nearly a third of all Jews had, in Germany, had converted. In fact, in no other country in the world, including the United States, had the Jewish population become so assimilated as it had in Germany. In a different historical context, Susanna Heschel argues that one of the main concerns of Shakespeare's famously anti-Semitic play, The Merchant of Venice, is the assimilation of Jews into Christian society and the possibility of Jewish conversion. This concern, she says, reflects an uneasiness in English society about Jews during Shakespeare's time. Even though no recognized Jewish community existed in England when Shakespeare wrote his plays, as the Jews had been expelled in 1290, a number of so-called new Christians or converted Jews had been allowed to return to the country and began to attract mistrust. In fact, at the time Shakespeare wrote his play, the personal physician to Queen Elizabeth I was a baptized Jew and was accused of trying to poison her and was subsequently hanged in a very public spectacle in 1594. Heschel says the presence of baptized Jews posed a new threat to Christian society. The Jew concealed within a Christian facade. In fact, fear of Jews who had converted to Christianity, who had led to one of the great anti-Semitic persecutions that had begun a century earlier, when tens of thousands of Jews, upon threat of expulsion from Spain, had converted to Christianity. These, quote, conversos, as they were called, became the principal concern of the Spanish Inquisition, which aimed to discover those Jews who had continued to practice their Judaism in secret. During the decades-long series of trials, as many as maybe 5,000 Jews may have been burned at the stake. The Inquisition, in fact, continued well into Shakespeare's time and also provided a cultural backdrop to Shakespeare's play. On the other hand, The Merchant of Venice also raises concerns over Jews' roles as moneylenders and usurers during the Middle Ages. By the early Middle Ages, the Church had formally begun to forbid clergy and laymen from engaging in the practice of loaning money at interest. And in 1179, the Third Lateran Council reconfirm the sanctions that said usurers could not receive communion or be buried as Christians. This led many Jews who had been driven from their professions by laws and prejudice to turn to money lending to earn a living, leading to Jewish involvement in the establishment of the European banking systems. Those scholars identified with materialist theories of anti-Semitism, including Karl Marx, whose essay, The Jewish Question, seems based on a depiction of the European Jew as Shylock, have sought to explain anti-Semitism as a hatred fueled by medieval class antagonisms. However, as Joshua Trachtenberg writes in his 1943 landmark study of the medieval conception of the Jew called The Devil and the Jew, quote, Jew hatred is often accounted for in medieval sources on ostensibly objective grounds, but the intensity of the reaction is so disproportionate to the reasons given, we are forced to pry deeper for the source of the emotional bias which made it possible for the Middle Ages to believe anything and everything reprehensible concerning the Jews. Beginning in the 11th century, popular resentment, excited by the Crusades, began to issue in a series of massacres, justified by a developing set of fantastic beliefs. First, that Jews ritually murdered Christian children, and eventually that these murders included the use of the victim's blood in the making of matzos, the unleavened Passover bread. This last was the most famous blood libel, which continued to be propagated during the Nazi era by Julius Streicher in the pages of Der Sturm. To these accusations were added those of torturing or desecrating the communion wafer, an extension of the deicide charge. And during the plagues, the bubonic plague of the 14th century, Jews were accused of causing the large numbers of deaths by poisoning the wells. In short, when Jews were expelled from England in 1290 and France in 1306, the Jew had come to be seen as the devil incarnate. Indeed, the best known visual representations of the mischievous fiend display a number of physical features medieval Christendom associated with the Jews. Check out Underwood Devil Ham label sometime when you're in the grocery store. The pointy beard, or goat's beard, a hooked nose. And we even see the devil's horns on Michelangelo's sculpture of Moses. It is true that the horns protruding from the brow of Moses in the sculpture can be explained innocently by a mistranslation of the Hebrew root Karen, a Hebrew homonym that can mean either beam of light or horn, in which the Exodus verse, quote, behold his faith sent forth beams of light, appears in the Vulgate, the standard text followed by the Catholic Church, as, quote, his face had horns. Nonetheless, the Vienna Council of 1267 decreed that Jews must wear a horned hat, a provision later councils sought to reinforce. This stereotype of the Jew as kin to the devil that emerged from the Middle Ages may have heightened the anxiety felt by Christian members of an increasingly secular society that was the product of the Enlightenment, especially during the 19th century, when Christian theologians looked for justifications for their beliefs in the form of an historicized Jesus, as their theological focus shifted to the historic nature of the figure of Jesus, they were confronted by the insistence of Jewish theologians that Jesus had been a Jew. However, as Susanna Heschel points out, that, quote, as a religion of incarnation, Christianity rests on a fragile boundary between the human and the divine, the carnal and the spiritual, and the Jewish and the Christian. The instability of this boundary is manifested, she says, in the figure of Jesus, who, quote, is the linchpin. He is at once a Jew and the focus of Christianity. Jesus begins his life as a Jew, but ends his life as a Christian. The psychological need to construct a more stable boundary differentiating Christian from Jew may have been the impetus during the Middle Ages for conjuring an imaginary Jew capable of all the dastardly wickedness attributed to him in the popular legends of the time. The idea that Jesus was originally a Jew who converted to Christianity later proved to be especially troubling to Protestants, who had rejected the Catholic doctrine of transubstantiation, in which the wafer and wine are converted into the actual body and blood of Jesus. This particularly Protestant anxiety about Jesus' Jewish beginnings is, I think, well illustrated in a poem by John Milton called On Circumcision. The fact that Jesus must have been circumcised shortly after his birth had seemingly always frustrated Christianity's attempts to separate itself from its Jewish identity. Milton, rather than acknowledge that Jesus' circumcision identified him as a Jew and follower of Mosaic law, describes the circumcision as the first drops of blood Jesus shed in his suffering for the sins of mankind. The poem clearly presents Jesus' circumcision as the first act in his crucifixion, and by extension makes the Jews the ones who physically crucified Jesus, as opposed to the Romans. More to the point, however, the poem divests Jesus' circumcision as a mark that would identify him as a Jew. One can see, then, the appeal a Nazi racial theory that made Jesus an Aryan and stripped him of his Jewishness held for the followers of the Christian faith. By the early 20th century, some Protestants had developed racist arguments that Jesus was not a Jew, but an Aryan who intended to destroy Judaism. While the picture of the Jew that emerged in Northern Europe during the Middle Ages as a figure of pure wickedness may have helped stabilize the boundary that separated the Christian self from the Jewish other, it also made faith in Jesus as the first Christian and model for all that is good suspect. In the end, only Nazi racial theory offered the possibility of cleansing the Savior's body of its Jewish stock. If Christianity identified itself in Pauline terms as, quote, Israel of the Spirit, and the other, Judaism, as, quote, Israel of the flesh, it may have been that Christians came to believe that the Spirit could only emerge as the result of a total renunciation of the flesh. In such a paradigm, the Nazi racist agenda might well have been the inevitable consequence of Christianity's inability to acquire an identity all its own without ridding itself of its Jewish elements and those who would remind Christianity of its legacy. I was promised some lively discussion.
One of the theories I remember reading about was that it was the fact that Germany had been destroyed during World War II, during World War I, and the fact that the economy was bad, and among other things, that they tried to blame the Jews on that. Was that part of the?
Well, Hitler certainly did. In Mein Kampf, he accused the Jews of having betrayed Germany during the First World War, and not having pulled their weight, German Jews not having pulled their weight. Of course, the actual facts disputed that claim that Jews fought and died in proportions greater than what they represented of the German population. Again, that falls in line with the materialist view, and to me, and I fall in line pretty much with Trachtenberg and some others on this. To me, the response, to that accusation is completely disproportionate. You know, all of us live with slackers, right? We don't perceive a small handful as being an existential threat. And so I have come to believe that there is something more profoundly psychological in anti-Semitism, and that it has actually been fairly stable, that it is not a product of historical circumstances. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Could you say something about the inclusion of speakers of Arabic in anti-Semitism and Aramaic as well?
I can. You may not want to hear this, but it shows some of the hypocrisy and what this is really all about. In 1942, I think it was May or June, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin El Husseini, escaped Jerusalem to join up with Germany, because Germany was bent on finding a solution to the Jewish question. When Husseini arrived in Berlin, he was personally greeted by Hitler with a proclamation declaring that all Arabs were honorary Aryans.
First of all, thank you. It's a very interesting discussion. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Nazi attitudes towards the Jews being based on racial, economic, and theological grounds, but you went back to Martin Luther in the 15th, 16th century. Mm-hmm. Was his aversion also based on those three, or was one more dominant than the others?
Well, I guess what I was suggesting is that they all, okay, that what troubled ultimately, sure, Jewish money lending antagonized some folks, and Jewish banking, sure, Jewish customs seemed odd and differentiated them. But what I was trying to suggest that I think at the heart of anti-Semitism is the anxiety a Christian culture feels about having a Jew in Jesus at its core. That if it tries to define itself in its own identity, okay, that this was deeply, deeply disturbing.
So then, was anti-Semitism, in your view, then born out of, I mean, only after Christianity, or was there some predecessor to it?
Well, that I didn't get into, and I find that an enormously interesting subject, and particularly its relationship to Christianity, because some of the Christian intellectual leaders in early Christianity, Origen and Eusebius, okay, were residents of Alexandria, which was a Greco-Roman city in Egypt, and all three cultures, ancient Egyptian culture, Greek culture and Roman culture, had their run-ins with Jews. And, you know, talking about what we're taught, I know when I was growing up, I was taught about how Christianity changed the Roman Empire. And I've come to ask, well, exactly how did the Roman Empire change what emerged as Christianity? Because the Christian canon doesn't actually appear until 322 CE after the Nicene Council, convened by Constantine, okay, and when Christianity becomes a official church. And it strikes me that Rome's involvement in the crucifixion of Jesus is grossly distorted in the passion narratives. And in fact, the Gospels contain no eyewitness testimony to the actual trials. There were two trials of Jesus, one before Caiaphas or the Jewish Pharisees, and the other before Pontius Pilate. No witnesses to that. And yet, Pontius Pilate is presented as acquiescing to the demand of the Jews, which would have been very much out of character historically with a Roman ruler and his obligations. Okay. That if a Jewish mob began demonstrating for something, the Jewish mob would have been put down, not the other way around. So I think you raise a really good question. I think I've read now that, you know, that's being, you know, I've read articles about it, more recent articles, but I don't think that area of inquiry is just fully developed.
Got a question over here. Marilyn Caldwell. With the backlash against the Nazis and in general, against prejudice, how do the Jews fare right now? in your estimation?
Well, you know, it's really, I can't say. I mean, if I were a German Jew in the 1920s, I probably would have felt, wow, things have never been better. I don't feel personally threatened, that's all I can say, but by anti-Semitism. Have I encountered anti-Semitism? Sure. But I've never felt particularly threatened by it. So,
I just want you to realize that not at all, it's not all anti-Semitism in Saudi Arabia where I was working. I had a friend who owned a lot of property and such, and he was telling me where he got his books and financial advice from. And he said, over in Bahrain. I said, you mean go all the way over there for an accountant? He says, yes, Jew. He says, who else can you trust?
Well, I don't know. It wasn't mentioned, but I lived in Israel for many years, and it was a very open secret that virtually our entire Israel's well-developed fashion industry was being supported by Saudis, that they were Israel's most important clients.
I have a question. I'm Barbara Bascom. This was Jim Bascom who made the other comment. Do you feel that there's been a positive impact on anti-Semitism as a result of the Holocaust literature and entertainment industry? Do you feel that that's had a positive impact on the whole thing? Do you feel that that's an
Well, you know, yes, I do think so. I think it's also resulted in some backlash. Norman Finkelstein's book called The Holocaust Industry, in which he argues that, you know, Holocaust literature, Holocaust movies, Holocaust plays are all really part of a well-orchestrated effort to shift American public opinion towards supporting Israel. And so
modern genetics tells us that everyone alive today is related to a small group of people, Homo sapiens, who had originated in Africa. Mm-hmm. About 60,000 years ago, crossed the Red Sea when it was waist high because of glaciation, and moved on to the Arabian Peninsula. And from that, all races alive today contain about the same amount of African DNA and have evolved into what we differentiate as different races. And that, of course, simply tells us that we all came from the same place, maybe a metaphorical Adam and Eve, and that we're all the same. Never mind that each one of us contains a certain percentage of Neanderthal DNA, because mm-hmm. when the people came across, they interbred with the Neanderthals who were already there. But I guess my point is that we all came from the same place, and yet it is a characteristic of human culture that differentiates him from her or you from me, because we may appear to be different in some way, and unfortunately the cultures and religions of the world continue to perpetuate that.
Mm-hmm. Me? Oh, I guess I'll be the last one. I'm going to put you to the point. What would you tell your students in the last lecture? I mean, really, have we in the West learned something from the Holocaust? And I'm really concerned, since you mentioned anti-Semites, including Arab-speaking people, you know, the anti-Burqa ruling in France and a mm-hmm. lot of the anti-immigration stuff that we see in Scandinavian countries. I mean, I feel a lot better being in America than I do being in Northern Europe. What do you tell the kids in Kansas? That was the last one.
You know, I don't, is the thing. I let them, you know, I do provide them, not with what I just talked about today, which was something in which I proposed a thesis of an explanation, but I do present some of the raw history of anti-Semitism, and when I let them read the literature, and I try to teach the literature as how Jews come to grips with what happened during the Holocaust. I think the Jews are pretty safe here. I think they're frankly pretty safe in Israel, but that's just my personal opinion.
And let's hope that they are pretty safe in Europe too. Thank you very much.
I will make a very small change. I will give you the closing words before we sing the hymn, and I also ask you now to join us for coffee. The blessing of truth be upon us, the power of love direct us and sustain us, and may the peace of this community preserve our going out and our coming in from this time forth until we meet again. Go in peace. We are going to sing hymn number 189. Please stand up as you're able to.